Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, we learn about a new robotic tool that helps in hip and knee replacement surgeries.
Sometimes things can be done more precisely and accurately using a robot, and that's where it comes into this field.
Plus, we get a sneak peek into the newest issue of that outstanding literary journal, The Healing Muse.
What The Healing Muse is doing is, in its title, it's saying that the arts can provide some healing.
And we'll hear about a support group that's really making a difference in the lives of men recovering from prostate cancer.
I think sometimes people get support just by being in the presence of other people who have gone through the same thing.
We'll get thoughts on end of life for a loved one and hear a poignant selection from our Healing Muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we discover how a new robot is playing an important role in hip and knee surgeries. Plus, we'll get a sneak peek into the newest edition of Upstate's award-winning literary journal, The Healing Muse. But first, how a local support group is making a real difference in the lives of prostate cancer patients. As our population lives longer and wishes to remain active throughout life, the demand is growing for surgical interventions that can help returning ailing joints to pain-free health. And here with a new technological advance on the scene to assist in this goal is Dr. Robert Sherman. He's assistant professor of orthopedic surgery, specializing in joint reconstructive surgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Sherman. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So the demand is growing for patients to maintain their active lifestyles. And, you know, as we age or just over time, you know, the joints wear out, hips, knees, whatever. Tell us what you see, what's happening out there.
We see a lot of patients in the office every day complaining of hip and knee pain. There are a lot of different ailments, and depending on your age and the type of injury you had, we'll see all different things. But today we're going to be talking a little bit more of our middle-aged and older patients that have a lot of arthritic symptoms. And patients come in complaining of achy pain in their knees and their hips when the weather changes and it gets wet out. And unfortunately, at this time of year, with the weather becoming fall and winter, this is the worst time of year when patients are complaining of that pain and stiffness in their knees and their hips.
And that's mostly due to arthritis.
Many cases it's due to arthritis.
So what have been the conventional, we're going to get on to this new technique, but what has been your conventional approach to help people with that kind of situation?
So we always try to start conservatively and do the lower risk procedures first. So we'll examine patients, we'll get x-rays, we'll make the diagnosis that indeed it is arthritis that's causing the problem. It's very common for people to come in and say, I have horrible arthritis, and it's something completely different. So it is important to be evaluated and to confirm that you actually have arthritis.
Let me just stop you there. So how do you make that confirmatory diagnosis?
It's based off examining a patient, evaluating how much motion they have in their knee, how stable their knee or hip is, and more importantly, old-school, old-fashioned x-rays are the best way to make the diagnosis. Patients always want an MRI, but to diagnose arthritis, x-ray is better than MRI. It's one of those few times that the cheaper and older technology is better than some of the newer technologies.
That's really good to know. So now you've determined someone has arthritis. So what's the next? What has been the next step?
So we'll, in all cases, we start with the simple things. We do injections with cortisone. We do injections with something called hyaluronic acid, which is a lubricant gel that we can inject in joints. We try bracing. We encourage weight loss. We encourage using a cane or a walker if it's necessary. We do a lot of physical therapy. And then we get into the surgical options, which may be an arthroscopy, where we actually go make a couple small incisions in, say, a knee and put a camera in there and look around, and we can use some instruments to clean up some arthritis and take care of some tears in the knee. Or more conventionally, when all that fails, we talk about hip and knee replacement.
So at this point, you would be doing, let's say, an arthroscopy.
the mechanism for doing that was just standard what? Explain and describe how that looks or what's involved.
Arthroscopy is indicated for patients that have a tear of their meniscus, which is a piece of cartilage in their knee, and come in with primarily locking and catching symptoms in their knee. And it's a good operation for somebody whose arthritis is mild, but their biggest complaint is that their knee is catching and locking. And we can debride the meniscus or cut out the torn part and allow it to move more freely.
So that has been a conventional method, and it's been successful.
Very successful in the right patients for many years.
But now you've got a new technology that we're going to talk about today. Tell us about it. And I understand it includes a robot.
So the robot and the new technology have to do with knee and hip replacement. And this is the next step after the injections, after arthroscopy. So when a patient has severe arthritis in their knee and all the other treatments have failed, we often talk about replacing their joint, whether it's a hip, a knee, or a partial knee. And we'll talk about that in a second. So conventionally, we talk about hip and knee replacement. And it's a great operation. It's actually the number two and number three most cost-effective operations that we do in this country, allowing people to have a much better quality of life and return to a much more functional a way of life. And conventionally, it's involved different techniques, but we now have a new technique to allow the knee and the hip replacement to be done much more precisely and much more accurately. And we hope that will translate into much better outcomes, and that the actual replacements will last a lot longer.
So as I mentioned before, and you haven't yet gotten to this concept of the robot, I know that, well, God, you just hear everywhere robots are taking over. I mean, they're being used in so many different things, whether it's to deconstruct an IED in Iraq or, excuse me, or to help with, recently I've heard that they might have Ebola patients treated with robots. I mean, there's this whole concept. So what is the robot doing for you? What exactly is the robot?
So there's all different types of robots, and a robot's a fascinating thing because oftentimes when we talk about robots, we think of looking back at Star Wars, C-3PO or R2-D2.
These
human-like things that are robots, but that's not accurate, and that is a type of robot. But in our case, the robot is a robotic arm that is connected to a series of computers that allows the machine to recognize where in a three-dimensional space the tip of that arm is located. Now, in all types of medicine, and as you mentioned, all types of industry, robots have taken over a lot of different positions. And
tasks.
It's a good thing, a lot of tasks. Robots can be used because it's safer sometimes to use robots. But I always think of it in the auto industry analogy. Sometimes things can be done more precisely and accurately using a robot. And that's where it comes into this field. Now, in the medical field, we always hear about the Da Vinci. And the Da Vinci is a wonderful device used for gynecological, general surgery, and other procedures. And in the Da Vinci, it's
also a robot.
It is a robot, and the surgeon is controlling the robot, not actually at the patient, and the robot's doing all the work. Well, orthopedics are a little bit different. So when we do a conventional hip replacement, for instance, we'll open up the patient, we'll expose their hip, we'll remove some bone, and then we'll put in a metal cup into their pelvis and a metal stem into their thigh with a new ball and socket, and that's how a hip replacement works. Now, we want those metal pieces to be positioned in the most accurate possible way. And all surgeons think that our eyes are perfect and that we're never wrong. And I hate to break it to myself and to other people. Occasionally, we're not 100%. So what we've been able to do, and we're actually the first facility between Buffalo and New York City that has this technology in New York State, is patients get a CAT scan prior to surgery. So we've made the determination that you need surgery. We get a CAT scan. Then we take the CAT scan and we build a three-dimensional model of either your hip or knee, depending on what we're doing. And we computer graphically build this 3D model that I can then look at. And I look at your anatomy and I say, in the case of a hip, this is where I want to put the cup. I want the cup to be at 45 degrees and 20 degrees this way, and I want it to be this deep into the bone. So I sit down and I mark it all out, and then this is all before surgery. And then we get into the operating room. And in the operating room, I do a conventional hip replacement. The incision's not much different than the incision that we've been doing all along. And we start the surgery off very similarly, but instead we mark certain points. We mark how long your leg is. We mark how far away the tip of your hip is to the center of your pelvis. And then we actually mark all the spots in the bone. And we have a special marker that has a tracker on it, and the robotic arm can read that. And it then correlates all the spots I put with the three-dimensional model we built before surgery. And as long as we're within a half a millimeter, the computer confirms that we've marked out all the spots correctly.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Robert Sherman. He's an orthopedic surgeon, and we're talking about a new robotic procedure to assist in joint rehabilitation. So, okay, so the robot really allows you to be very precise and very accurate in terms of the placement, in this case, of a total hip replacement. How about with some of the other procedures you were talking about as well?
So the other aspect is in partial knee replacements. As of today, the robotic device can be used for partial knee replacements and total hip replacements. The total hip replacement, we just talked a little bit about how precisely that puts it in. A partial knee replacement is like a total knee replacement, but instead of replacing the whole knee, you're replacing just one aspect of the knee, whether it's underneath the kneecap, the inside part of your knee, or the outside part of your knee. And this is really good in patients that have arthritis in only one area of their knee. So we don't need to replace their whole knee if it's only in one area. The hard part is, conventionally, it's hard to see things if you're only working in a small window. So again, it's a much more precise way to put in that partial knee replacement. Just as in the hip, we mark out certain spots, we build a three-dimensional model, and then the robotic arm comes in with a burr attached to it and actually minimally removes as little bone as necessary to allow a metal piece to fit into where the arthritic bone was and recreate the knee joint.
Can we also get a picture of is the surgeon like at a joystick? And in other words, the surgeon sitting at a console, the patient is on an operating table of some kind, and the arm is doing...
Well, that's more like how the Da Vinci in general surgery and okay. In gynecological surgery is.
So how does this
in
work?
In this situation, the surgeon is always in control. So the surgeon isn't sitting at a console. The surgeon isn't sitting in front of a computer module. The surgeon's actually controlling everything, and the actual tools are in the surgeon's hand. But also, that tool's connected to my hand. I have full control on it. I'm the one that puts the power on and the power off. But it's also connected to a robotic arm. And that robotic arm is connected to a series of computers that knows in a 3D dimensional model exactly where I am. So, for instance, if I'm doing the surgery and my assistant bumps into my elbow, it won't let me go outside where I want to go. So it's a way to help accurately and precisely put these pieces in exactly where we want.
So it's a major assistant. It's, in other words, it's like a surgical assistant that keeps you in a certain plane, in a certain direction, and moving only, you know, so your placement is exactly accurate.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. It's a second check system to make sure that where I want to go is where I actually want to go, and confirms it based off of the patient's anatomy.
So what do you think? I mean, you've done this now for a bit, am I correct?
Yes, I have.
So what kind of outcomes, how have the outcomes changed? Is there, for example, less time in healing and rehabilitation? What's the impact of this?
A lot of it we don't know yet, and a lot of it is going to be trends, and I can't tell you for 15 or 20 years whether this is actually going to pan out to be as great as we think it is. And the problem is, conventionally, knee and hip replacements last around 10 to 20 years. So every time we change something, we can run it in simulators, but simulators don't actually recreate what they are in humans. So I have to wait 15, 20 years to tell you whether this is going to make it any better than what we're doing today.
In terms of longevity, but how about in the short term in terms of patients?
What we know is that the components are placed in a much more accurate position. If, for instance, 5 or 10% of the time, the components are not exactly where we think they should be, this may decrease that to less than 1% of the time. So if you're the 90% of patients that it was put in perfectly, it won't change anything. However, if you're that 10% of patients that it wasn't put in where we thought it was, you're going to now get a more accurate, precise placement of your
joint
replacement.
And does that translate into functionality, improve functionality?
We think patients are going to have less pain, more mobility, easier recovery, and more importantly, we hope and think that maybe instead of lasting 15 years, we'll get 20 or 25 years out of it.
Those sound like very positive benefits and certainly worth the effort, I think. And it sounds like, does it make your job a little bit easier as well?
It does make my job a little bit easier. It helps accurately and comfortably. When I leave the operating room, I know everything's perfect. I don't have to second guess myself.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing that very, very exciting information with us. My guest has been Dr. Robert Sherman. He's assistant professor of orthopedic surgery, specializing in joint reconstructive surgery at Upstate Medical University. Well, here's to the robot. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Next, we'll get a sneak peek into the latest issue of Upstate's literary and arts journal, The Healing Muse. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here along with you. The Healing Muse, the award-winning annual literary and visual arts journal from Upstate Center for Bioethics and Humanities, is about to release a new edition. And joining us again is its editor and a regular contributor to this show, Dr. Deirdre Nealon. She's Associate Professor of Bioethics and Humanities at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Nealon. Welcome, Deirdre.
Thank you,
Linda.
It's good to be back here with you.
It's always good to see you. So let's remind our listeners who may not be familiar with The Healing Muse, what is it? What's your mission?
Okay. It's a visual and literary journal, and its mission is to contribute to the overall improvement of patient welfare, patient care that we have at Upstate.
And how would you say a visual and literary journal does that?
I would say that it does that by providing both practitioners and patients and caregivers the opportunity to reflect on their illness or disease, to reflect on what it's like to be a physician or a nurse, to reflect on what it's like to suddenly hear some words you didn't expect to hear, you have, and then fill in the blank. I think that writing and the arts give us a tremendous boost toward healing, that we get to maybe organize what it's like to suddenly have your world turned upside down. And so what The Healing Muse is doing is, in its title, it's saying that the arts can provide some healing. The reflection, the musing about illness can actually maybe bring us to a better place.
So the themes are basically medicine, illness, disability, and healing.
Yes.
Personal, basically usually, almost always, personal stories of some kind. And it's short stories, poetry.
We do that. We do memoirs. You can write about yourself, autobiographical pieces. We do essays. And yes, a lot of poetry and fiction. And now, in addition, we also have photography. Painters submit their works, sculptures. We put those visual representations of them within the pages as well.
How long ago did the Healing Muse begin? And you what know, was the or, you know, what was the germ of that?
Yeah, thank you for asking, because it's always fun to go back in the past. Our journal began 14 years ago, and it was the brainchild of a woman who was a professor, Bonnie St. Andrews. And her idea was, and she was particularly interested in the nurses at this point at Upstate, but her idea was, we don't hear from the people who are on the front lines of caring. And she said to herself that when she was teaching classes in writing to the nurses at our College of Nursing, she was struck by how many stories, dramatic stories, they are participants in, and yet there's no outlet for them. We did have the beginnings, I think, that we expect physicians to write about things. We're very interested in when physicians tell us anything, but we hadn't really thought about what nurses do. And so Bonnie thought, wouldn't it be good if our university would start a journal? And so her original idea was this would just be a journal for Upstate. But she quickly, after the second year, realized that people were telling other people about it, and people wanted to write for it who didn't just come to Upstate.
So bottom line now is you have submissions from where? I mean, basically all over the country?
All over the country. I mean, just in this issue alone, Linda, we have 38 states and 7 countries represented, that, wow, that, you know, submitted to us. So, yeah, thanks to the web. I mean, certainly the internet has given people who live far away the chance to be right up close talking to us, and that's been a wonderful boon for us.
And to actually experience the Healing Muse. I mean, they can, yes, see parts of it.
Yes,
and they can...
definitely. We're online. You can, you know, check us out that way. And then if you are selected, if you're accepted, we give you 2 free copies. We're not paying our writers and artists, unfortunately, yet, but someday I long to be able to do that. But in the meantime, they get 2 free copies of a really beautiful journal.
Have other medical schools jumped on that same wagon? I mean, are we the only medical? I can't believe it's the only medical
school. No, we're
not
the only one, but we are one of the first that has done this and made it look so professional. Some places essentially are still the old stapler, and we put some pages together, or we're just online. But there are a growing number of universities that are very interested in having their medical students and medical practitioners think about writing, think about taking some time, because time is, as we all know here at the medical university, time is a premium. But if you just rush through the day doing patient after patient, you know, seeing one person after another, and you never take time to think about what it was like, yeah, what is that person telling you? When you tell him or her you have asthma or you have diabetes.
Or cancer.
What is it like for that person to hear you? And what I have noticed is an increasing desire on the part of the physicians and nurses to almost reflect back on what must it be like to be the patient? And I find that a very powerful movement in medicine, that they are now actually willing to sort of step outside the white coat for a second and think, you know, I'm a man, I'm a woman too, I'm a mother, I'm a father, I'm a friend, I'm a daughter. What's it like to hear this diagnosis and write about it?
And actually, that's part of what you told me at one point is a key theme that seems to be running through this year's edition.
Yes, it's very interesting to me that, you know, we don't ever ask for a theme. We haven't done that yet. We simply say we have open submissions and, you know, send us what you want. But as I'm putting it together each year, I'm always thinking to myself, well, is there any kind of common theme? Is there something in me this year that I'm looking for something in particular unconsciously? I didn't know it. And I think that this year I have found that we selected many medical personnel who are doing 2 things, not just talking about what it's like to be the nurse or the physician, but really talking about what it was like to be the patient. And I just like that idea that they have expanded their worldview so that it's not just the profession now, but it's the profession engaged with a real-life person.
Really humanizing
experience.
Yeah,
I think so. If
you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Deirdre Nealon. She's the editor of Upstate's literary journal, The Healing Muse. We're talking about the healing effects of writing, perhaps. So you have brought something to read to us today to illustrate some of these concepts. Tell
yes.
us a little bit about what you've brought.
I've brought you a poem that we used to close our issue. I chose this for the concluding piece because its power and its poignancy still almost give me shivers when I read it. This is a poem called I'm Sorry, and it was written by a physician who is also a father, and he's a father who lost a daughter. And this poem takes you through, in a very few stanzas, the entirety of what it's like to lose a part of yourself that way. And I think it shows you what the Healing Muse is capable of doing, that we will just take a second after we hear this poem and we will think, oh. And I find that part of art, you know, just so beguiling. It's just very powerful. So let me try. His name is Dr. Bill Rector. I'm sorry. For what happened, for what I didn't do, for what I couldn't, for this world, for death, for the hour today when I didn't think of you, for myself, for all of us left to fill the silence with a lyric from the only song we know. I'm sorry too, you reply. Sorry you couldn't sleep, Daddy. Sorry you did. Sorry your dreams did not include a message from me you could understand. Sorrier still if you didn't dream. Sorry for the endless vacancy I left behind. Sorry they forecast rain and you woke up to snow. I'm sorry, dear. Yesterday we put away your pictures, all but one, kept high in the recesses of my bookcase, showing the two of us on a jet ski. You steered, I rode on the back. Remember? We turned over in the middle of the lake. Sorry, 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 Daddy, you cried, thinking I'd be angry at such clumsiness in one who worked so hard to be a grown-up. Don't worry, I told you, treading water. We're wearing life jackets. I was wrong.
Wow.
So you see what I mean there? I mean, it's such a human emotion, a father and a daughter, and suddenly that person is gone. And you try to make sense of it, and it will never make sense. But that poem gives you such a shape to, we had a relationship, it was powerful, it was real. And even though that person physically has gone, it's very obvious she's going to live forever in this poem.
In addition to how it perhaps impacts the listener, tell us how you think it impacts the writer.
That's a really excellent question, because when I got this poem, I wrote to Dr. Rector immediately, and I just said to him, I'm so moved by what you have written, and I would, you know, love to publish it. And he wrote back and said, it means the world to me that it will be published, but it also means the world to me that you would talk to me, even though you don't know me. And he said, that's what poetry has done for me. It keeps me in the world at a time when, you know, I wasn't really sure I wanted to be in the world. And so I think that there is a power, and I try and say this in my classes when I'm teaching the medical students or the nurses, there is a power that comes when you sit down to write, to put words on paper, not a text message on a phone, but words that actually will go out on the internet, will go out in this beautiful book, somebody else will read it, and you know, your story lives again. I find that incredibly seductive.
I also saw at one point, I think you might have said this, but I recall that somehow when we write, we organize our thoughts, we create paragraphs, or in this case, stanzas, that can defy or minimize the disorder in the world and the disorder that we feel. Somehow, maybe it gives us a sense of control when in fact, there is no control.
Yeah, and I think that's particularly apt when we're talking about therapeutic writing, when we're talking about people who have illness or people who are treating people with illness. It can be overwhelming, just the diagnosis and then all of the steps to prognosis and treatment. And I think that when we write, we do give ourselves, maybe it's an illusion, but it can be a very powerful illusion. When I write that, well, you know what, I will take control of this. I may have this diagnosis, but I am still me, and I'm going to write about that.
I'm not the diagnosis.
Exactly.
I remain a human being.
And there actually, Linda, have been some experiments done where people feel better. They've done some studies with people who are experiencing diabetes, and when they have them meet once a week in writing groups, those people actually seem to be doing much better health-wise than the people that are not in the control group writing.
Well, it sounds like there's a just what you said at the very start, that there's a healing quality to sharing, to expressing through art, what it is you feel, what it is you've experienced, trying to make order out of what appears to be senseless or disorder. I mean, it sounds like the act of creating art and participating in art in some way, through, in this case, through the literary journal and visual journal, really has a tremendous healing power.
I think it does. And one of the nice things is that the writers can go off and read in public. We take people to different campuses, and we do some Healing Muse readings there, and that equally sets us off on more journeys of writing.
How can people get copies of this edition?
Oh, it's very easy. Just go to our website, thehealingmuse.org. And we will tell you exactly how to get to us.
And it's
only
actual,
$10.
It's an actual edition. And I mean, it's a
ask for volume 14.
It's a really beautiful piece.
Oh, thank you, Linda.
Thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Deirdre Neal, and she's Associate Professor of Bioethics and Humanities, the editor of The Healing Muse. Once again, thanks for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. My mom is dying. Well, folks, as I say this, my mom is dying. I sang happy birthday to her 2 days ago on her 98th, but she didn't know it, or maybe she did. I couldn't tell. There are very, very difficult decisions at this time. Some we were able to anticipate and mercifully made in advance by talking together a few years ago, like, do you want a respirator if you can't breathe? Or a feeding tube if you can't eat or drink on your own? My mom said, no, 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 no. And we wrote it all in a living will. Thank you, Mom. That made things a whole lot easier. Others we didn't anticipate, or we couldn't know when we made them what they would feel like when this time came. I found the only thing that makes these things easier is talking with people who've been there before. So I'm sharing this with you all in mind. Like, I didn't know if Mom would be in pain without a feeding tube as she ate and drank less and less. So I asked a physician from hospice. He told me that there's no discomfort of hunger or thirst because those signals to eat and drink are shutting down as the whole body shuts down. A feeding tube just interferes with nature. But that didn't help when Mom was sleeping through her meals, but eating some when she was awake. Do we wake her to invite her to eat? What do we do when she doesn't recognize food and drink in front of her, but will still eat if we put it in her mouth? Then are we keeping her alive longer in this lying in bed all day state, often not recognizing me or anyone, agitated, scared, hurting on and off, but still able to swallow? In return for what? Well, here it gets really hard, because mixed in with hours and days of scared or blank stares or pushing me away angrily, there are moments like me giving her spoonfuls of sherbet just a week ago and she looking in my eyes and cooing, oh, oh, like a toddler, and smiling and kissing my hand with every spoonful for 10 minutes. And me looking into her eyes then and caressing her face and her head and she mine and her saying, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Wonderful, Mom. Thank you for sharing your life with me. Goodbye, sweetie. And good luck to all of you listening when the time comes for you folks. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Up next, how a local support group is making a real difference in the lives of prostate cancer patients. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, and it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of December 8th. Clean, separate, cook, and chill. You know, it's good to know that the four components to keeping food safe are clean, separate, cook, and chill. Make sure to clean work surfaces, utensils, appliances, your hands, and food completely before working with them. Separate raw meats, poultry, fish, and their juices from other food. Clean cutting boards, serving trays, utensils, and your hands after they've been in contact with raw meats. And always cook food to the specified temperature and safely store your leftovers. This week, check that your refrigerator and freezer are set to the proper temperatures, below 40 for the fridge and below zero for the freezer. Then be aware of your kitchen practices for the rest of the week, making sure you're keeping raw food separated and washing surfaces and cooking equipment thoroughly. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Other than skin cancer, prostate cancer is the most common cancer in American men and the second leading cause of cancer death, behind only lung cancer. The American Cancer Society estimates over 230,000 new cases of prostate cancer will be diagnosed, and almost 30,000 men will die of the disease in 2014 alone. Getting the diagnosis can be a frightening experience, and like so many other serious diagnoses, support can be crucial. Well, here with more on this are Jason Warshall. He's an account representative for hospitals with the American Cancer Society in Syracuse, and Ray Straub. He's a prostate cancer survivor. Thanks for coming in. Welcome to you both.
Morning. Thank you.
Jason, let's just start by laying out some initial stats. Prostate cancer really affects mostly older men. Is that true?
Well, prostate cancer really can affect any male. Typically, we see prostate cancer in one out of every six men is actually diagnosed with prostate cancer. Some younger, some older, but the majority of cases, as you said, typically are within the 60s to 70s.
And it obviously can kill. So what are some of the early detection guidelines for prostate cancer?
So as of right now, the American Cancer Society guidelines for screening for prostate cancer really are to kind of have an informed discussion with your family care general practitioner or urologist.
Beginning at what age would you say is important?
It varies depending on race or ethnic background. If you're African American, we recommend having the discussion a little bit earlier, between 45 and 50. If you're Caucasian, to start around 50 to again have that discussion of whether PSA testing and DRE testing are right for you.
Let's talk about that very briefly. PSA testing is a simple blood test. Is that correct? And they're looking for something in your blood that's an indicator that potentially you may have prostate cancer brewing?
So PSA, prostate-specific antigen, is a blood test, as you said. It is a relatively easy test to perform. There are some benefits and limitations to the PSA tests, and it's been somewhat controversial as of recently.
What's the DRE?
So the DRE is a digital rectal exam, and that is physician providing and feeling the prostate gland to see if it's irregular, to see if it's enlarged, to see if there are bumps or nodules that could indicate something is there.
So you basically, the American Cancer Society says for Caucasian males starting at about age 50, you begin that conversation and perhaps begin to screen.
Exactly, and really to start a conversation with your doctor, because the tests themselves are not definitive. They don't tell if you have prostate cancer. They also don't tell if you have a more aggressive or a less aggressive type of disease. So starting the conversation and really being open with your doctor for prostate cancer screening is something that the American Cancer Society recommends at this time.
And there also has been some controversy, as you've alluded to in the recent past, about treatment modalities. Can you help us understand that too?
So I think, we've progress in today's society, especially with medical technologies, there are many treatment options for prostate cancer. If you are diagnosed with prostate cancer, the hard part here is deciding which way to go and which treatment you're going to choose. A group like the Men-to-Men group is something that can help kind of spell out the different treatment options that are there. And really working with your physician to choose the best treatment option. You know, and I'm sure we'll hear about this later, but, you know, watchful waiting is one. You know, if you have a less aggressive type of disease, you know, robotic prostatectomy is something that is an option, as well as radiation. So kind of weeding through each one of those and deciding what's best for you as a person diagnosed with prostate cancer is a discussion that, you know, is very important.
Which is exactly the segue that you made, and Ray, to you. You've been very active in this men-to-men group. This is a group of what? Prostate cancer survivors? Tell us about this.
Well, men-to-men, formerly man-to-man.
It was called man-to-man, now it's men-to-men.
Now with since Upstate has taken over the sponsorship, it's men-to-men. And it's a group of its history goes back to the, I think to the early 90s in Sarasota, Florida, and there's been an active group in the Syracuse area I think since the mid 90s, and we want to keep true to the roots and have the have the purpose of the meetings be a group of men getting together and sharing their experiences and getting support.
So what led you? I know that you've been very active as a facilitator and all that, and I want to get into the group, the dynamics of the group and what the group's mission is, but let's step back for just a minute. Tell us a little bit about your story. How did you get involved, and what's your story with regard to prostate cancer, if you don't mind
sharing? Well, no, I don't mind, and the interesting part is that I didn't know about Men to Men until after my treatment was concluded. And a friend of mine told me about the group, and I started to go after I had my prostatectomy back in 08, and went just to get the information and be exposed to the speakers and get the support in the aftermath and offer support to the others that we're there.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Jason Warshaw from the American Cancer Society and Ray Straub. He's a prostate cancer survivor. We're talking about a support group for prostate cancer patients. So let's get back to you, Ray. What's the mission of Men to Men? What is it? How often does it take, you know, do your meetings take place?
Well, it is for support, and Upstate has been very helpful in getting providing speakers to most of our monthly meetings. We meet on the last Thursday of the month at 5 o'clock at the HealthLink offices near Carrier Circle, because that's Route 298, right next to the DoubleTree Hotel.
And what's the purpose of your meetings? You said speakers. So is it largely, Jason, is it largely education as it's?
Well, support, I like to mention that it comes in three ways, or two or three ways. One is the getting the information from the speakers that have been good enough to offer their time to present a wide variety of topics. And then we always try to have an open discussion where people can ask questions of other people who have gone through the same situation, and I think sometimes people get support just by being in the presence of other people who have gone through or go through the same thing. And we have people there that have been either are still going through treatment 20 years from when the first diagnosis was, or they've been finished with treatment for more than 20 years. And sometimes we'll have people there that were diagnosed for the first time last week or have had a recent recurrence.
So you really have the full range.
It's a full range
of people. Generally, how many people attend these meetings on a monthly basis?
We usually have about 20 to 30 people.
Really?
On the weeks and in the months where there's a speaker.
It's and fewer. The speakers, give us a feeling for the kinds of topics that you've been that have been addressed.
Some of the diagnosis methods and we've had some sessions on the different, you know, PSA and what the method, you know, what the methods are for following up with that, some of the side effects that people have to deal with depending on what their treatment options are. And there's a wide variety of treatment from surgery to a variety of different radiation treatments, active surveillance. It's a wide range.
Jason, how does the American Cancer Society play a role here in terms of providing support for prostate cancer people, patients and survivors?
So the American Cancer Society, as a national non-for-profit, we offer programs and services to assist those that are newly diagnosed with prostate cancer and with any type of cancer. We are unique in the sense that we offer 24/7 support, 365 days a year. We have our 1-800 number, 1-800-227-2345, you know, available 24/7. You can call and get up-to-the-date information on prostate cancer, cervical cancer, colorectal if you're diagnosed. Maybe you have questions about insurance. Maybe you have questions about clinical trials. We are a way to help navigate patients nationally, locally, and, you know, really provide support. Our connection with the Men to Men group, as Ray mentioned before, it was an American Cancer Society program. We've since transitioned out of facilitating those, and, you know, with the help of Upstate, Dr. Brodslavsky, the chair of the urology department, you know, we've put together a great partnership. You know, we're here to really reach out and, you know, work with the patients that are newly diagnosed through the urology department, provide this as an additional resource, and really want to help, you know, those newly diagnosed with prostate cancer. And at the same time, you know, offer our resources to those that are newly diagnosed as well.
Well, it sounds like you have a monthly meeting and that people, there's no fee involved, obviously, in getting involved. Is that correct?
That's correct. No fee, no sign up, mandatory sign up. People can come as often as they want. Some people come to one meeting and that's it. And some people come to all of them and listen and share. And
what do you think the group has done for you? You were already through your experience, and yet you found the need to find this kind of a group. What has it done for you?
Well, I guess I get the support in all three of those ways, and I do enjoy being in the company of the other people that, you know, had the same experience. I really wish that I had known about Men to Men before I made the decision on what my treatment was going to be. I don't think my decision would have been any different. I think I still would have chosen what you know, the surgery route, my age and the type of prostate cancer that I had. I don't think I would have made a different decision, but I would have liked to have gotten a little bit more detailed information from other people that had gone through
and
it.
Now you're playing that role, actually, because by being a facilitator of this group, you're taking people who are newly diagnosed potentially and giving them your wisdom and sharing the wisdom of all the others who also have gone through it. So that's a wonderful service. We'll have a link on our website, HealthLink.
And I'm not
on
the
air.
Only facilitator. There are six of us.
That's great. We'll have a link on our website, HealthLink on Air, as to how and when, you know, how to find out more about it. And clearly calling the American Cancer Society or Upstate's HealthLink Connect, which we'll have on our website, people will find out more about it. I think it's a fabulous thing that you're doing, and it sounds like more people continue to come.
Yes, and we are noticing an increase in attendance.
Any last points you'd like to make, Jason, about prostate cancer or about the need for this kind of a support group?
You know, I think, you know, as men, you know, face different cancer diagnosis, Men to Men is an opportunity to really learn about your disease. And, you know, with the experiences that our guys have gone through, I think is a great opportunity for people to learn. The American Cancer Society, you know, is available with prostate cancer information and really any type of diagnosis. You know, we try to
not
look
limited to prostate cancer,
right? And I think maybe my final words of wisdom is that if you're a male, you know, please make sure you are talking with your doctor about prostate cancer screening, the benefits, the limitations. Excuse me, of the test. You know, colorectal cancer is another disease that's there. Our national initiative right now is to increase colorectal cancer screening rates. Currently in New York State, they're about 67%. Our national goal is to get it up to about 80%. So
I bet you'll reach your goal.
I hope so.
I want to thank you for coming in. My guests have been Jason Warshall. He's an account representative for hospitals with the American Cancer Society in Syracuse. And Ray Straub, he's a prostate cancer survivor and active in the group Men to Men. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Linda.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Thank you. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Sometimes the hardest part of an illness, ours or someone we love, is in the waiting. Our physician or nurse practitioner may have a good idea about what is wrong, may suggest some of the thoughts they're having, but usually they want to wait, run some tests, see what those tests say, and then call us back. And so we wait. Playwright, poet, and performance artist Janice Butler Holm captures this state of suspended animation, of stasis, concisely in her poem called Lab Limbo. There he was, sitting and waiting, hoping, sitting and waiting and hoping, hoping the news would be good. Sitting and waiting and hoping, he wondered and pondered. He wondered and pondered and waited and hoped. Sitting, he waited and wondered and pondered. He hoped for good news. How he hoped. Hoping, he sat and waited. He wondered, he pondered, he hoped, and he hoped. He sat there hoping, hoping and waiting. He wondered and pondered and hoped. How he hoped. Sitting and waiting, he hoped and wondered. He pondered with hope and wonder while sitting, while waiting. Waiting and wondering, sitting and pondering, he hoped for good news. There he was.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore those troublesome varicose veins and what can be done about them. Plus, how seasonal flu can truly be deadly and the importance of getting your flu shot. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Conjol, and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.